The case became even more intriguing when Le Monde disclosed Gorgi's ties with François Jeannot, a mysterious Swiss banker and Hitler worshipper.
That, by the way, is a name to store away in a big way for later.
That's right, and it's spelled G-E-N-O-U-D. We hear about François pretty often these days. Jeannot is also a bibliophile of sorts. He holds the posthumous rights to the writings of Hitler, Bormann, and Goebbels. Jeannot's most recent preoccupations, however, have been legal rather than literary. He helped finance the defense of Klaus Barbie, the butcher of Lyon. Barbie's attorney, a flamboyant ultra-leftist, I'll read that again because we want to put that in quotes, a flamboyant ultra-leftist named Jacques Vergès had worked with Jeannot for many years. Vergès, in turn, became the lawyer for the, quote, friends of Wahid Gorgi in negotiations with the French government. Vergès had previously represented Georges Ibrahim Abdallah, the Lebanese terrorist now serving a life sentence for murdering a U.S. military attaché and an Israeli diplomat. Last year's bombings in Paris were unleashed in an effort to secure Abdallah's freedom. The Gorgi affair is all the more disturbing in light of ongoing far-right overtures to Iran. In England, for example, leaders of the National Front, the country's most violent fascist organization, openly sing the praises of racial and cultural, quote, nationalists such as Louis Farrakhan, Muammar Gaddafi, and the Ayatollah Khomeini.
Nip, not to be corny, but you might want to read that last sentence, or repeat that last sentence again, because that's relevant to a few
things.
Talking about
those names pretty frequently, haven't we? The example in England, for example, leaders of the National Front, the country's most violent fascist organization, openly sing the praises of racial and cultural nationalists, quote-unquote, such as Louis Farrakhan. That's right, Louis Farrakhan from the mosque in Chicago.
Also affiliated with the Aryan Nations from time to time.
That's right.
Which now perhaps does not seem as surprising as it might have when we first discussed it.
No, Louis Farrakhan, Muammar Gaddafi, and the Ayatollah Khomeini. National Front members have reportedly spied on Iranian dissidents in England for the Khomeini regime. One National Front publication effused about Khomeini's Islamic Revolutionary Guards, quote, their belief in their cause is so strong that they will run through minefields unarmed to attack enemy positions. Their ideals are so all-consuming that they will drive truck bombs into enemy camps knowing full well their death is inevitable. This power, this contempt for death, is the stuff of which victories are made, unquote. This may seem rather bizarre, given that Farrakhan, Gaddafi, and Khomeini are, by culture and skin coloring, exactly the type of people that British packy bashers, quote-unquote, and the French New Right want to ban from their countries. But Iranian fundamentalists and neo-Nazi fanatics are united, not only in their intense anti-Semitism, but also in the belief that there must be no, quote, cosmopolitan race mixing, unquote. Both agree that Europe and Islam should remain separate cultures free from the decadent influence of the two superpowers. A recent study by the European Parliament warned of an alarming growth throughout the continent of racist and xenophobic attitudes that, quote, create a fertile breeding ground for right-wing extremism. With the emergence of Jean-Marie Le Pen as a significant political force in France, the extreme right can no longer be dismissed as a fringe movement. Le Pen, a notorious Arab hater, caused a stir when he suggested that historians may have exaggerated the Holocaust. While ominous in and of itself, the rise of the radical right in Europe may pose an even greater danger if its hate propaganda and terror is covertly subsidized by governments like Iran. Wahid Gorgi certainly could have shed some light on this unholy alliance, but those who wish to interrogate him will now have to put their questions in a letter addressed to Gorgi's new residence in Tehran.
One of the interesting things about that article, again, when in describing the affinity of the third position fascists for people like Gaddafi, who we can understand, Khomeini, who we're beginning to understand, and Louis Farrakhan, one of the things we should take a look at historically, and one of the analogies that we've talked about in the past, is what I at least feel is a very close analogy between the functioning of the Nation of Islam in contemporary America and the Beitarim or revisionist Zionists in Europe. In Europe, one of the things that has been forgotten by most people concerning the history of the Second World War and the Third Reich was that there was a community of interests between, for a while, the SS and overtly Zionist elements, specifically the Haganah. The SS, before the final solution to the Jewish problem, was actively promoting Jewish emigration to Palestine as a means of getting Europe, quote, Judenrein, Jew-free. And by the same token, before the final solution, the fascist Zionists, the Beitarim, a group of Jews who were explicitly fascist in their outlook, formed a political alliance with the SS because they, for a while, were working for the same thing, at least up to a point, namely to get Jews out of Europe and into Palestine. It is this racial separatism that forms one of the main points of common ground between the third position fascists and people like Khomeini and Gaddafi and Louis Farrakhan. And just as George Lincoln Rockwell was able to find common ground with Elijah Muhammad, just as I've forgotten his last, his last name is Miles. This fellow Miles, who's a Michigan Klansman and Aryan Nations member, and I've forgotten his first name off the top of my head, but he was hooked up with Louis Farrakhan, and Farrakhan attended, or representatives of his attended an Aryan Nations meeting. This is the same kind of an alliance. The Beitarim were explicitly fascist Jews. They were really two groups. They were the Beitar, headed up by a guy named Vladimir Jabotinsky, who openly espoused the Mussolini line of fascism, trained with Mussolini's naval cadets, and were actually reviewed by Il Duce. And they made it very clear in an article in L'Idea Zionistica, the Italian Zionist newspaper, that they weren't just, this was not just a pragmatic alliance to gain Il Duce's assistance, but that they actually believed in the same things. Then there was also the Stern Gang, an even farther right group of explicitly Nazi-oriented Jews, headed up by Yitzhak Shamir, Menachem Begin being the key figure in the Beitar that has survived to us from the Beitar period. Again, the point being that I think people should think very carefully whether Louis Farrakhan and the Nation of Islam really have the best interests of black people at heart, and my feeling is that they are in exactly the same kind of a situation that Menachem Begin and Yitzhak Shamir were vis-a-vis the Third Reich for a while. And it's also interesting that recent weeks we've spoken about the Nation of Islam's participation in the Tawana Brawley affair with Reverend Al Sharpton of FBI and probably CIA fame as well. It's interesting to contemplate the Nation of Islam basically as a bunch of potboilers in this country. Sharpton, incidentally, was reported by Warren Hinkle of the New York Times, or of the San Francisco Chronicle, to have probably been involved in, among other things, CIA activities in Grenada. And it's very interesting. It doesn't take much imagination to see him stirring the pot beneath Maurice Bishop in much the way that he appears to be stirring the pot under the Democratic political leadership of New York State and the New York State legal system at this time, and thereby discrediting black politics in the eyes of many people, white and black, in that area. I can easily see Al Sharpton telling people that, well, you know, Maurice Bishop and his people just didn't have the true revolutionary interests at heart, and if they really wanted to do it, they ought to get this fellow Austin and some others and back him up and overthrow Maurice Bishop. Doesn't take much imagination at all, particularly in light of the fact that we had Frank Turple on Grenada at about that same period of time.
What it all boils down to, and we're going to be taking a break first, and yeah, we're going to be taking a break first, and then we're going to be listening to a tape. But what it all boils down to, we're talking about two separate things, as it appears they're being presented to us that way. But again, we're being manipulated. We're seeing two different puppets, but we're not seeing the puppet master behind the black cloak. We're just seeing the two puppets, the right hand and the left hand, sticking up over the top. We're reacting as if those are real people. They're not. They're connected. They're connected down below, out of sight. You can call it a conspiracy if you want to. You can call it anything you want to. But yeah, it's manipulation, and it works.
And again, the phrase community of interest, there are long-standing affiliations between elements of Nazism and Middle Eastern nationalism, both Palestinian and Iranian. The Shah and his father, the first Shah, had overt Nazi sympathies and were removed by the British from power temporarily for those same reasons. In fact, the Shah's title in Farsi was Shah-on-Shah Ari-Amer, Shah of Shahs, Light of the Aryans. This whole thing goes back quite a long ways. When Mossadegh was overthrown, he was replaced by a fellow named Fazola Zahedi, a former Nazi intelligence official, or agent, I should say, whose son, Ardashir Zahedi, became the ambassador to the U.S. So these connections go back a long way. And
I was going to say, we've talked about old Pierre Jamil and the Jamil family, who have been running the Falangist Party for years. Well, that's where the Falangism comes from. Falangism comes from fascism, from the Falanges. And it runs around, folks. It's not a new connection, and it's not a new way for people to be confused as to who's who.
And again, I think one of the things to bear in mind here is the phrase community of interests. Think about how the Nazis benefit from having a bunch of wild-eyed Palestinian-Iranian terrorists running around throwing bombs. That way they can point to the quote sand niggers, unquote, and the quote diaper heads, unquote, and stir the political pot for their own benefit on the right, a la Jean-Marie Le Pen. And think about the Ayatollah, and think about how, again, the domestic bankruptcy of the policies of the Ayatollah, who's turned Iran into a wasteland, and Ronald Reagan, who totally bankrupted America, this fiscal conservative, in 8 years, and think about the extent to which each of them depend for their political careers on political capital generated by the perceived outrages of the other.
While you're thinking about that, we're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a few minutes with more One Step Beyond right here on KFJC. We are in the studios at KFJC, and we have been talking about a number of things tonight. By the way, of course, that was the Fire Sign Theater with Fighting Clowns, and a little bit from that.
In the War Zone.
In the War Zone, very appropriate. And, of course, everybody recognized that gravelly, whining voice, says Robert Zimmerman from Hibbing, Minnesota, with God on our side. And what we're talking about tonight is who is exactly on which side. Are they the left? Are they the right? Are they both? And how does that affect us? And in fact, with the Iranian airline disaster, or the shooting down of the Iranian airline, which we didn't really talk about tonight except in passing, in the news, and the war zone being just that, a war zone in the Middle East, it's time to reflect on a little bit on who exactly is pulling our strings and what do they have in mind for us.
Yeah, now this evening, again, we're talking about the Fascist Third Position, the first of a couple of programs, and tonight's broadcast, by the way, is going to go into the archives. We're now going to dip back into the archives for some background information. Now, in the article by Kevin Coogan and Marty Lee, a couple of brilliant researchers whose work we're going to be touching on again in this this two-part series on the Fascist Third Position, may even go, ultimately, it may hook up with old Noam Chomsky, but in that article from the Oakland Tribune by Marty Lee and Kevin Coogan, the connections between the European right, specifically French fascists and François Janoux, an old Nazi intelligencer and Swiss Nazi banker, and the Iranian Islamic militants and elements of left terrorism in general, is front and center. We're now going to dip into a book called Unhealed Wounds by Erna Paris, and we're going to talk about you're going to hear on tape a number of different connections, again, by way of illustrating further the intersection between European fascists, the community of interests, if you will, between European fascists and Middle Eastern terrorists of both Iranian and Palestinian stripes, and European, quote, leftist terrorists, unquote, because in actuality they appear to be more right acting under left cover than left themselves, but there are certainly plenty of fanatics. And we're going to talk about the intersection between people like Haj Amin al-Husseini, the Galen group that went over to the Middle East under Alan Dulles, François Janoux, Jacques Vergès, Klaus Barbie, a fellow named Otfried Hepp, Abu Abbas, and a whole lot of other superstars from Terrorfest 88. And this program, by the way, this tape segment that you're going to be hearing, is a supplement to Radio Free America number 22 that is on permanent file at Archives on Audio, and obviously this will be included in the broadcast this evening. So here is a segment from the supplement to Radio Free America number 22.
Now, this first half hour to 45 minutes or so this evening is going to consist of some excerpts from a book, a currently available book called Unhealed Wounds, subtitled France and the Klaus Barbie Affair. That's authored by Erna Paris, first name E-R-N-A, last name Paris, just as in Paris, France. The book was published in soft cover in 1986 by the Grove Press Incorporated, New York. And it's copyright 1985, published in soft cover by the Grove Press, New York. Now, recapping very briefly of some of the main information from Radio Free America number 22, We began Radio Free America number 22 by dealing with some interesting elements of the U.S. of the Olympics massacre that occurred in Munich, Germany in 1972. Specifically, we talked about some elements of that unfortunate event which are not generally well known. Specifically, we took a look at the man generally credited with planning and leading that attack, a man named Ali Hassan Salameh. We took a look at the fact that within just under a year after leading the Olympics massacre, Ali Hassan Salameh was working for the Central Intelligence Agency in an anti-terrorist capacity, supposedly anyway. We also took a look at the fact that the Galen agent, the BND agent who was in charge of security for the U.S. Olympics, for the Olympics massacre in 1972, a man named Hans Langemann, was working setting up agent provocateur groups with a former head of the West German Federal Police named Hans Kollmar, last name K-O-L-L-M-A-R. Langemann, by the way, is L-A-N-G-E-M-A-N-N. And Ali Hassan Salameh, A-L-I-H-A-S-S-A-N-S-A-L-A-M-E-H is the spelling on that. We also took a look, at, in Radio Free America number 22, at a degree of historical continuity between elements of the Palestinian movement, which had been affiliated with the Third Reich even before the Second World War, and we traced some of these elements up through the Palestinian terrorist movement and through the Olympics massacre of 1972. That's not to say that by any means all Palestinians or all elements of the PLO are terrorists or connected with the Nazi underground or the U.S. and Western intelligence apparatus, but many elements of them are. It's worth noting in this context that the PLO is a very diverse organization, highly fractionalized, and in fact many of the elements are at bitter odds with each other. Elements of that, of the PLO, are affiliated, however, with the U.S. intelligence system, and there, in turn, the U.S. intelligence system has acquired many of these elements from many of the elements of the Palestinian movement that had been traditionally associated with the Third Reich. Now, Ali Hassan Salameh, the fellow who led the Olympics massacre, was associated with George Habash's PFLP, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, and the same fellow who went to work for the CIA, has been associated through his family with a man named Haj Amin al-Husseini. Haj Amin al-Husseini, who we're going to talk about some more this evening, was the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, and later he went to work for the Third Reich as a major in the SS. Among the people who worked very closely with Haj Amin al-Husseini was Hassan Salameh. Hassan Salameh is the father of Ali Hassan Salameh, the leader of the Olympics massacre. Hassan Salameh worked as a commando during the Third Reich, and then fought, along with Haj Amin al-Husseini, against Israel following the establishment of the State of Israel. Later, Ali Hassan Salameh, his son, married a woman from the family of Haj Amin al-Husseini, the former Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, spiritual leader of all Palestinian Muslims for a time, and eventually, as we indicated, a major in the SS. As I also indicated, the chief of security for the Olympics massacre, Hans Langemann, a member of the Galen organization, the Nazi Eastern Front intelligence outfit which jumped to the CIA at the end of World War II, began working later with Hans Kollmar, head of the Bundeskriminalamt, the West German Federal Police, as setting up basically what appeared to have been agent provocateur groups. He was setting up terrorist groups ostensibly for the purpose of infiltrating terrorist groups in Germany. Indications were, however, that this group, supposedly to infiltrate terrorists, had in fact established terrorist incidents themselves. We're going to begin picking up sort of where we left off at that time, and we're going to take a look at some interesting connecting elements between the post-World War II Nazi underground, some Nazi intelligence operations which were run out of the Galen organization, the Nazi spy outfit that jumped to the CIA at the end of World War II, and we're going to connect many of these elements up with not only Palestinian terrorism, but with terrorism in general, and terrorism going on to this very day, some elements which are active to the moment. We're going to begin by taking a look at two individuals named Jacques Verges, last name V-E-R-G-E-S, J-A-C-Q-U-E-S is how his first name is spelled, and also a very, very important man named François Genoud, G-E-N. O-U-D is his last name. Of course, François is F-R-A-N-C-O-I-S. Now, reading now from the book Unhealed Wounds by Erna Paris. We're going to begin by taking a look at Jacques Verges and his relationship with François Genoud, and we're going to begin taking a look also at just who François Genoud is. Reading from Unhealed Wounds by Erna Paris. It was June 15th, 1983. Jacques Verges had become Klaus Barbie's sole legal counsel. Interrupting, of course, Klaus Barbie was the SS captain from Lyon and later U.S. intelligence agent who was extradited to France in early 1983. Continuing. Berger merely smiled mysteriously when asked who was paying his fees and his expenses for trips to faraway places like La Paz, Bolivia, to collect evidence and interview witnesses. François Genoux, on the other hand, was slightly less reticent. In an interview with Stern magazine, he said that he would, quote, neither confirm nor deny, unquote, his involvement in the Barbie affair, adding that, quote, everyone has his hobbies, unquote. Among Berger's acquaintances, however, the answer seemed evident. Quote, if Jacques needs money these days, he has only to go to Switzerland, confided a friend. It has long been known in various European circles that, quote, a Swiss citizen who lives in Lausanne, L-A-U-S-A-N-N-E, has managed the Nazi treasury since the fall of the Third Reich. The money, most of which was stolen from European Jews, was deposited in numbered bank accounts through a clandestine club of former SS officers called Die Spinne, the Spider, the successor to the Odessa organization. In March of 1965, Le Monde indirectly identified this individual as François Genoux. In 1969, the Centre d'Information et de Documentation Moyen-Orient in Brussels confirmed the identification. By the way, that would be the Center of Information and Documentation for the Middle East, translating from the French. Recapping the important aspect of the last section, François Genoux basically was the person who has controlled from Swiss bank accounts the post-World War II Nazi treasury. The Nazis had anticipated their defeat long before the end of the war and stashed away a great deal of capital for the financing of post-war Nazi activities, something which has sort of unfortunately been relegated to the realm of pulp fiction, but which is in fact a very real and current reality. Continuing with Unhealed Wounds, François Genoux personifies a hybrid of ultra-left and neo-Nazi extremism that first appeared on the international scene after the last war. One might even say he created the type along with a handful of others. His Nazism came first. Genoux was born in Lausanne in 1915 into a bourgeois family that appreciated law and order, unquote. In the early 1930s, before Hitler came to power, his parents sent him to Germany in the hope that he would pick up some of the discipline of the emerging new regime. During his stay, Genoux was introduced to Hitler and actually shook his hand. He read Hitler's writings and found them very relevant, unquote. The teenager was an instant convert. François Genoux returned to Switzerland a convinced Nazi, and he has never lost his faith. Back in Switzerland, Genoux made contact with Georges Ultramare, O-L-T-R-A-M-A-R-E, the head of the Swiss fascist party, L'Union Nationale. According to his own account, however, Genoux preferred the pro-Nazi Front National, which he joined in 1934. In 1936, he traveled to Palestine, where he met an individual who, like himself, would eventually combine the presumably polar opposites of fascism and extreme left-wing nationalism. Haj Amin al-Hussein was the ex-Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, and he was to become one of Genoux's links to the Arab world. In 1940, the military attaché at the French embassy in Bern, Switzerland, noted that Genoux was involved in disseminating anti-French propaganda. Also around this time, Genoux was contacted by an agent of the Abwehr, by the way, that was the German military intelligence service during World War II, beginning again. Also around this time, Genoux was contacted by an agent of the Abwehr for work in the German intelligence service. And during the course of the year, he disappeared from Switzerland to travel through Germany, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, and Belgium. During this period, and immediately following the end of the war, Genoux made the acquaintance of several extremely prominent Nazis, including SS General Karl Wolff, W-O-L-F-F. Wolff was Himmler's personal adjutant as far back as 1933, and in 1939, he became Hitler's liaison officer in the Führer's headquarters. In 1943, Wolff was supreme SS and police leader in the Italian campaign, and it was he who negotiated surrender on April 29th, 1945. He was also part of Hitler's plan, later abandoned, to kidnap Pope Pius XII in September of 1943, after the fall of Mussolini, with a special regiment of 2,000 men. Wolff was a consummate Nazi. According to a document submitted to the court at Nuremberg in 1946, he had greeted, quote, with particular joy, unquote, the information that, for 2 weeks now, a train has been carrying every day 5,000 members of the chosen people from Warsaw to the killing center at Treblinka. In 1984, just before his death at the age of 84, Wolff gave an interview to a Swiss journalist in which he spoke of how much former Nazis everywhere owed to François Genoux. After the war, while they were in prison or in hiding, Genoux acted as an intermediary, Wolf said. In particular, he was involved in bringing aid to German soldiers and officers who were being held in French prisons. Genoux claims that he was not involved in helping Nazis escape from Europe, but only, quote, because the occasion did not present itself, unquote. On another occasion, he explained himself further, this time with regard to Klaus Barbie. I did not help Mr. Barbie escape, he declared. It would not have been a dishonor to help National Socialists flee, but as it happens, I did not, unquote. As part of his ongoing commitment to the ideology of the Third Reich, Genoux became a publisher of important Nazi materials. He holds all posthumous rights to the writings of Hitler, Martin Bormann, and the Nazi propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels, according to a financial agreement concluded with members of all three families in 1945 and 6. In 1952, representing himself as an agent of the Hitler family, Genoux brought charges against a Paris publishing house that had produced Bormann's account of Hitler's conversations without his permission and won. And in 1956, a court in Cologne agreed that he owned the rights to the posthumous works of Goebbels, causing a scandal among people who claimed that the royalties from such writings ought to be in the public domain to compensate Hitler's victims. In 1973, Genoux sold the rights to the Goebbels diary, a 16,000-page manuscript with a Baroque history of its own, to Albrecht Naus, last name K-N-A-U-S, the director of Hoffmann und Kampf Verlag, a Hamburg publishing house, and in 1981 Naus, who by then had his own publishing house in Hamburg, brought out Hitler's Political Testament, as purportedly dictated to Martin Bormann. The preface to the book explained that Genoux had acquired the document in 1946 at the time of the Nuremberg trials. It seems that ex-SS Captain Hans Reichenberg, R-E-I-C-H-E-N-B-E-R-G, who had the document, went to the Nuremberg trials to act as an advisor for the defense. There, through his former superior, General Hermann Rahmke, R-A-M-C-K-E, he met François Genoux, a friend of Rahmke. During the course of a developing friendship, he confided to Genoux his photocopies of 18 chapters of the book. By 1955, Genoux's second career as advisor, researcher, and banker to the cause of Arab nationalism had begun. One of the keys to that seemingly unlikely transition can be found in Hitler's Political Testament. In the preface, Genoux explained that he planned to have the book translated into Arabic and Swahili because in the body of the text, Hitler invited the people of the Third World to carry on the work of the Thousand-Year Reich. Let me repeat that last sentence. In the preface, Genoux explained that he planned to have the book translated into Arabic and Swahili because in the body of the text, Hitler invited the people of the Third World to carry on the work of the Thousand-Year Reich. In 1955, Genoux was in Tangiers, one of the ports where Nazis seeking to escape European justice took refuge. He was also frequently in Cairo, where he worked in the Egyptian intelligence service under Nasser. Cairo under Nasser had been the center of the pan-Arab movement since 1945. These were important years, the years in which Nazism and the developing ultra-left began to merge. And François Genoux was at the center of events. With his friend Hans Reichenberg, who also had discovered a new outlet for his career in the Arab world, Genoux created an import-export company called Arabo Africa. That's A-R-A-B-O and Africa A-F-R-I-K-A. The business was primarily a cover for the export of anti-Semitic and anti-Israeli propaganda, and the delivery of weapons to the Algerian FLN movement. Genoux made financial investments for various friends, Hans Reichenberg and Dr. Hjalmar Schacht, S-C-H-A-C-H-T, Hitler's finance minister, among them. Genoux also renewed his friendship with Karl Wolf, who had found his way to Nasser's Egypt. Cairo in the 1950s was paradise for Nazis with nowhere to go and nowhere to apply their carefully honed talents. In the emerging world of Arab nationalism, they found a new outlet for their profound anti-Semitism and their propaganda skills. It was in this milieu that François Genoux first met the nine leaders of the nascent Algerian insurrection. Ahmed Ben Bella, Mohamed Kider, K-H-I-D-E-R, Ait Ahmet, A-I-T-A-H-M-E-T, Mohamed Boudiaf, B-O-U-D-I-A-F, and their colleagues had formed the Provisional Government of Algeria. Genoux's skills as a financier made him infinitely valuable, and before the end of the decade, he had established bank accounts in Switzerland on behalf of the North African Liberation Armies of Morocco, Tunisia, and Algeria. The system he used involved multiple signatures, just like the system that was already in use for secret Nazi funds. Let's go back and recap some of the important aspects of this particular passage. First of all, François Genoux was reportedly the fellow, and there's a lot of information to support this, who had been providing much of the financing for Jacques Verger, the lawyer, the defense attorney for Klaus Barbie in his impending trial in France. As we've seen, François Genoux was an avid Nazi, worked very closely with Nazi intelligence before and during World War II. After the war, he not only became the heir to a great many Nazi documents, such as Hitler's political testament, he also, and perhaps more importantly, became the key Nazi banker, that is, the man controlling and dispersing the massive funds secreted away by the Nazis during the course of World War II in anticipation of their impending defeat. We've also taken a look at how, prior to the war, François Genoux became acquainted with Haj Amin al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem and SS officer who figures so prominently in the milieu that emerges in connection with the Olympics massacre. We've also taken a look at how François Genoux traveled to the Middle East and was very active in Egypt and worked in the Egyptian intelligence service, and became a key financier also for the emerging Arab nationalist movement. Now, this is a very key connection because, as we looked at in Radio Free America number 22, our program about the Olympics massacre, the Egyptian intelligence service, as did the Libyan intelligence service after it, had its origins with a group of Nazi war criminals dispatched for the express purpose of forming these intelligence services, and that those Nazi war criminals were acting on behalf of the Central Intelligence Agency. Specifically, Nasser had requested help from the CIA in forming not only his general staff, but his intelligence service. Since the CIA had connections with Israel, did not want to alienate Israel by sending any of their regular agents, they turned to Galen, who dispatched a bunch of Nazi war criminals, most of them virulent anti-Semites. This group put together the Egyptian Intelligence Service, and later the Libyan Intelligence Service. That group is headed up by Otto Skorzeny, a major in the SS, actually a colonel in the SS, and a fellow who was basically in charge of commando training for the Third Reich. Skorzeny, in many ways, could be said to be the grandfather or the godfather of modern terrorism. Skorzeny, ultimately, or at least nominally, was headed up all commando training for the Third Reich, as I said. And in that capacity, at least in terms of chain of command, had to have had Hassan Salame under his command. Hassan Salame had worked in an abortive commando mission to establish an Arab uprising in then British-held Palestine as a way to siphon off British strength from the impending Nazi offensive in the Battle of the Bulge, or what became the Battle of the Bulge once the engagement began. It's interesting that François Genoux was working for this Nazi intelligence group because, as we looked at in a book called Skorzeny, Hitler's Commando by Glenn Infield, it was while heading up this Nazi intelligence group in Egypt that Otto Skorzeny set up the first Palestinian commando groups which operated in the Gaza Strip. The first Palestinian terrorists were set up by Otto Skorzeny, according to Infield, while working on behalf of CIA and Galen in this area. So we have François Genoux hooking up with this milieu right at this point. We'll take a short break, and then we'll continue with the information we're presenting. Go Free America number 22, reading from Unhealed Wounds by Erna Paris. The next piece of information we're going to take a look at concerns the first conference of third world nations in Bandung, Indonesia. That's Bandung. We're going to pick up the story, the thread of this historical connection that we're looking at that point. Reading once again from Unhealed Wounds by Erna Paris. In 1939, Amin al-Hussein, the ex-Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, took refuge from the British, escaped to Germany, and attached himself and his followers to the Nazi cause. Heinrich Himmler, the SS chief, was delighted. It wasn't every day that a regiment of sympathetic Muslims joined the German war movement. Himmler respected the Mufti and often complimented him on his blue eyes, which he liked to describe as appropriately Nordic. But it was in a written note to the Mufti that Himmler eventually struck a chord that would resound as a leitmotif for the future and survive four decades to influence the context of the Klaus Barbie affair. Quote, "The struggle against Judaism is at the very heart of the natural alliance between National Socialism and those Arab Muslims who burn with a desire for freedom," he wrote. "This alliance will endure until a final victory," unquote. In 1955, the Mufti resurfaced at the seminal conference at Bandung, Indonesia, where the idea of the Third World first took hold. 29 countries from Africa and Asia, representing more than one half of the world's population, sent delegates to discuss common problems with an emphasis on colonialism. Among the Arab countries, however, hatred of Israel quickly emerged as a common theme. The representative from Iraq spoke of, quote, the force of evil, unquote, and called Zionism, quote, one of the blackest, most somber chapters in human history, unquote. Nasser had a few choice words to say in a similar vein. But the most surprising and convincing polemic of all came from Amin al-Hussein, who arrived on a surprise visit as the representative of Yemen, a country he had apparently never seen, and proceeded to reveal... One second, I've got to skip past the plates here. Proceeded to reveal to the collected constituents that the real ambition of Israel was to annex the entire Middle East. The significance here, of course, in light of particularly of, according to François Genoux, Hitler's desire that the Third World should carry on his struggle against Judaism, is that the former SS man, Haj Amin al-Husseini, should emerge in a key capacity at the seminal conference forming the notion of the Third World, or the concept and functioning milieu of the Third World. So we have Haj Amin al-Husseini, an associate of François Genoux, at the Bandung Conference and apparently functioning in a key capacity. And apparently also, the Grand Mufti, in the next section of Unhealed Wounds that we're going to look at, was instrumental in drawing much of the post-World War II neo-Nazi movement and some of the surviving Third Reich veterans into an alliance with elements of the Palestinian movement against Israel. Returning to Unhealed Wounds. In April of 1969, a Congress of the neo-Nazi Neue Europäische Ordnung was held in Barcelona with 50 delegates from Europe and Latin America, most of them former SS officers, nostalgic Vichyists, and Franco supporters. The Vichy French, of course, were the French fascists who governed on behalf of the Nazis in France. The new European order had been a strictly Nazi-oriented outfit, but now, 15 years later, the focus of their international meeting was the Palestinians. Yasser Arafat sent a representative from El Fatah to explain the needs of the PLO and present two requests. The first concerned the need to recruit non-Arabs for sabotage operations, fundraising, arms supply, and the mobilizing of mercenaries and foreign instructors for training camps. The second request was for money for the dissemination of anti-Zionist propaganda in Europe and South America, including a wider distribution of the protocols. The El Fatah representative convinced several former Nazis to work directly for the cause. Karl Vandeput, V-A-N-D-E, capital P-U-T, a Belgian who had served Germany in the Africa Corps, offered to recruit young Europeans with military experience for El Fatah. Former Nazi officer Johann N. Schuller, S-C-H-U-L-L-E-R, was already involved in arms sales to El Fatah. He had also begun to recruit former Nazi officers as instructors in El Fatah guerrilla training camps. Even the ubiquitous ex-Grand Mufti of Jerusalem turned up in discussion. It was announced that he had recently formed a new unit of sabotage. Palestinian leaders began advertising in the Nationale Zeitung in Munich, asking for volunteer war correspondents, unquote, with tank experience, unquote, to fight Zionist imperialism. By the late 1960s, satellite television was able to transmit events all over the globe, rendering the possibilities for propaganda almost limitless, quote, we think that killing one Jew far from the field of battle is far more effective than killing 100 Jews on the field of battle because it attracts more attention, unquote, Dr. Habash confided several years later in an interview with Oriana Fallaci. By that, Dr. Habash, by the way, is George Habash, the head of the Front for the Liberation of Palestine, Popular Front, the PFLP. It is worth noting that he spoke of Jews, unquote, and not Zionists, unquote, as the target of terrorism. Before 1970, his PFLP had hijacked several foreign planes in full view of an international audience and blown up four, killing Jews and Gentiles alike. Next, we're going to move on to some of the direct connections between Jacques Verger, François Genoux, Verger, the radical lawyer who also has strong connections to the Palestinian movement, who defended, is defending, apparently, Klaus Barbie. François Genoux, of course, the Nazi sympathizer, and during and post-World War II Nazi activist, and the man who controls not only the post-World War II Nazi treasury, according to this book, but also was instrumental in funding and handling the financing for the international Palestinian movement and Palestinian terrorism in particular. A reporter from Haaretz said this is when Jacques Berger was in Israel. Oh, actually, I'm going to skip down in this section. This is incorrectly marked here. Returning once again to unhealed wounds. In December of 1968 and February of 1969, PFLP terrorists hijacked El Al planes in Athens and Zurich, respectively, and at their subsequent trial in Winterthur, Switzerland, they chose Jacques Berger as their legal counsel. Although he was once again refused permission to participate, Berger went anyway as an advisor. Also present as an advisor, unquote, was François Genoux. The possibilities for propaganda at the Winterthur trial, by the way, Winterthur is W-I-N-T-E-R-T-H-U-R, beginning again, the possibilities for propaganda at the Winterthur trial were too important to be left to amateurs. There were international press conferences, and an anti-Zionist brochure called The White Book was widely circulated. The defense was paid by the Banque Commerciale Arabe, which had by then adopted the Palestinians primarily on the recommendation of Ali Hassan Salome, otherwise known as Abu Hassan, the leader of the Black September terrorist cell that was later responsible for the murder of Israeli athletes at the 1972 Munich Olympics. Abu Hassan lived in Switzerland, where he had established an easy friendship with François Genoux. I'm going to read that last couple of sentences again because it's key and it ties in many of the elements that we're discussing this evening with the gut information from Radio Free America 22. The defense was paid by the Banque Commerciale Arabe, which had by then adopted the Palestinians primarily on the recommendation of Ali Hassan Salome, otherwise known as Abu Hassan, the leader of the Black September terrorist cell that was later responsible for the murder of Israeli athletes at the 1972 Munich Olympics. Abu Hassan lived in Switzerland, where he had established an easy friendship with François Genoux. In 1982, Genoux publicly acknowledged his deep involvement with El Fatah. In fact, he had long looked after their European operations from every point of view. He gave advice regarding the investing of huge amounts of money donated to the cause, not least from Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, who contributed $50 million to the PLO after the Munich assassinations. He provided legal counsel for Fatah men who needed help in Switzerland and underwrote other costs, including at least a partial subsidizing of a multinational terrorist organization that had set up shop in Paris, first under the leadership of Mohamed Boudia, who was murdered by the Israeli Secret Service in 1973, then under Carlos the Jackal. He was, in his own words, quote, an economic counselor with a special interest in the developmental problems of the Third World, unquote. Indeed, his interest in developmental problems, unquote, led him to continue his business dealings as an arms merchant specializing in sales to the Palestinians. Well, of course, the significance of these passages, we not only have Jacques Berger and François Genoux connected up with the PFLP, a group with which Ali Hassan Salome was also affiliated, but we have direct connections here between Ali Hassan Salome, the leader of the Olympics massacre, son of a Nazi intelligence agent, associate of the Grand Mufti, with François Genoux, the post-World War II Nazi banker and literary tract controller, I guess you could say, to coin a phrase. We also have Genoux handling funds apparently dispersed by Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, and also handling the defense and the subsidizing for the trials of terrorists associated with Carlos the Jackal. Well, of course, Colonel Muammar Gaddafi's terrorist organization, as we looked at in Radio Free America and others, in Radio Free America number 4 and other shows, the terrorist training for Gaddafi came from Frank Turple and Edwin Wilson, the, quote, ex-unquote CIA agents who were so very much involved with arming the Gaddafi machine. Incidentally, Frank Turple also boasted of training Carlos the Jackal, and as we looked at in Radio Free America number 4, Carlos the Jackal's life, apparently, according to Jack Anderson, was saved by the CIA. So there's an interesting connection there. On top of that, of course, we have the association of Muammar Gaddafi in a group called the Internationale Fascista, which is just as its name implies, an international fascist terrorist combine, and the co-bankroller of the Paladin mercenary group, one of the main elements of the Internationale Fascista, was none other than Otto Skorzeny, working with Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. So Gaddafi and Skorzeny. Skorzeny setting up Gaddafi's secret service and, work, of course, setting up the original Palestinian terrorists associated later with Gaddafi in the Paladin mercenary group. And we have, of course, this same milieu now intersecting directly with François Genoux and Jacques Berger, Barbie's defense attorney.